From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
As this year's Florida lawmaking session begins, Governor DeSantis has just one ask of lawmakers.
Get the bills to my desk. In the spirit of 1776, I'm happy to put my John Hancock on those pieces of legislation.
Also this week, despite some tiffs and occasional hard feelings, most Florida lawmakers seem determined to smooth out the lingering rough spots with their colleagues this year.
The burden of proof is on us to work with our friends in the House and listen to their points of view.
We'll also hear from Cubans living in Florida who yearn to see their homeland made free, and we'll find out if the future of Uber is literally up in the air. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from the 2026 lawmaking session in Tallahassee.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org.
The Florida legislature officially got its 2026 lawmaking session underway this week. It all began Tuesday after the House and Senate met separately to transact some mostly perfunctory business in the morning. It was time for Governor DeSantis's eighth and final State of the State speech. Around three quarters of it was a litany of accomplishments during his tenure, such as a better state economy.
If you stacked that $800 billion our economy has grown in these last 7 years, in the air using $100 bills, that stack would extend 543 miles high, more than twice as high as the International Space Station.
Improvements in education, like higher teacher salaries and more school choice than ever.
Now, 7 years ago, Florida's school choice options were capped. They were limited. Today, we have universal school choice and rank as the number one state in the union for parental empowerment and education freedom.
He mentioned one very bipartisan effort, Everglades restoration.
We've completed a record number of projects, tripled the water storage capacity throughout the Glades, and advanced the completion of the EAA reservoir by 5 years.
And it was only at the very end of his speech that the governor quickly ticked off a to-do list of things the legislature might pass this year, such as slashing property taxes, AI regulation, tougher immigration policies, and less tough gun laws. The governor had but a single request.
Get the bills to my desk. In the spirit of 1776, I'm happy to put my John Hancock on those pieces of legislation.
The Democratic House and Senate leadership had their say in their pre-recorded messages after the governor's speech. Senate Minority Leader Lori Berman took DeSantis to task for pushing an off-year congressional redistricting effort.
He's pushing an illegal, politically motivated redistricting effort to give Republicans an unfair advantage at the polls.
Berman says she and Senate Democrats would like to see the state keep trying to reduce property insurance rates.
The governor and the House would prefer instead to cut property taxes, which would cripple our cities and counties.
Speaking of the House, that chamber's minority leader, Fentress Driscoll, listed some things she'd like to see if her party had any power at all.
We would better fund our public schools, ensuring that every child in Florida has access to a high-quality education. Next, we would set aside the partisan politics and accept the federal money that comes with Medicaid expansion. The number one issue we hear about from our neighbors back home is the outrageous cost of housing. Rent is sky high and home ownership is exorbitant. Floridians are suffering. We would tackle this problem immediately because Florida is becoming expensive for too many Floridians.
But the divisiveness in the Florida legislature isn't a purely partisan thing. Last year, disputes and hard feelings between the governor and the Senate, and often the Senate and the House, got so tense that it took an extra 45 days for the legislature to pass a budget. And even today, some of the animus still lingers. At the end of his State of the State address, Governor DeSantis raised some eyebrows in the chamber when he declined to shake the outstretched hand of House Speaker Daniel Perez. Perez was asked about the snub later by members of the Capitol Press Corps.
Whether the governor wants to be petulant and, you know, not shake the hand of a partner, that's on him. It's not going to change our direction. Our direction is that of the pulse of the membership and what's important to them.
Meanwhile, Senate President Ben Albritton has had a few disagreements with both the governor and the House Speaker. But ever the diplomat, he adopted a conciliatory stance during his news conference on the session's opening day, first referencing Governor DeSantis.
He did a very good job of reiterating what I think has been excellent policy and appropriation strategies over the last several years with a host of speakers and a host of presidents during the governor's tenure here. And I am going to remain positive. I'm going to do everything in my power to work with the governor and the speaker to build wins for Floridians. And I'll leave it at that.
So we're off and running in the 2026 Florida lawmaking session, plus however many special sessions might ultimately be needed. The Florida House and Senate have already passed several of their priority pieces of legislation during the first week of this year's legislative session. But as Tristan Wood reports, there's not yet agreement on whether and which of those policies will become Florida law.
Senate President Ben Albritton's $218 million Rural Renaissance Package, steering money to cash-strapped rural communities, has cleared its chamber, joining an overhaul of the state school voucher laws, and more. The House, meanwhile, has okayed a bill reducing the age to buy rifles and shotguns to 18, and another requiring all employers to use the work eligibility checker E-Verify. Both the House and the Senate passed most of these bills last year, but they were held up in tense negotiations that extended last session long past its typical 60-day runtime. This year, Albritton says he's hopeful his rural growth bill will pass, especially because, he says, it has received backing from the Trump administration.
The federal government and President Trump's leadership is interested in a renewal, whether it's a renaissance or whatever you want to call it, but a renewal in rural America. So I'm hopeful this year. I'm optimistic this year.
House Speaker Daniel Perez says he hopes the Senate is on the same page with his chamber's bills.
I'd love to have a partner in the Senate. That's our goal. That's what we want. What would I like for them to move? Everything that we pass off the House floor, I mean, if we're being honest. But look, there'll be a time for that. I think we have always welcomed the conversation with the Senate, or the governor for that matter.
And Pensacola Republican Senator Don Gates says he's hopeful about his voucher reform bill.
The burden of proof is on us to work with our friends in the House and listen to their points of view.
Despite all that optimism, none of the leaders answered questions about whether their chamber is actually supporting the others' proposals. Perez was tight-lipped about rural renaissance.
Whether it's important to him or not, it doesn't change the direction of the bill itself. If the members want to hear the bill will be heard. If they don't want to hear it, it won't be heard. And if they want to vote it down, they can vote it down. If they want to pass it off the House floor unanimously, they can do so as well. But as of right now, you know, that's a process that will take place over the next 60 days.
That uncertainty comes as the two chambers have come down on seemingly opposite sides of Speaker Perez's feud with Governor Ron DeSantis. Perez has messaged in favor of reducing state spending and has previously floated cutting taxes, while Albritton has been hesitant to support cutting state revenue. And the governor did not shake hands with or acknowledge Perez during his State of the State address. Those issues still remain, and both chambers' policy plans are looking to be important pawns in larger conversations that will happen this session. I'm Tristan Wood.
Coming up on Capitol Report, Florida may not be Cuba, but the two lands are now and forever linked as Cubans in Florida struggle to reclaim their homeland.
I'd like to see the current dictators accept a negotiated exit so that we can start rebuilding Cuba.
Changes in Florida law as well as federal immigration policy have placed a growing number of immigrant laborers in mortal danger.
As you watch the film, you'll know that there's long-term effects that result from exposure to extreme heat.
And your airport chauffeur could soon be a pilot instead of a driver.
Is this going to be like the Jetsons? Is it flying Ubers? Is it air taxis? I think you could actually probably say yes to all of those.
The Republic of Cuba is facing its worst economic crisis since the communist revolutionaries seized power 67 years ago. This comes after the United States arrested Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in a brazen operation on January 3rd. That action left at least 80 people dead, including 32 members of the Cuban military that provided security for Maduro. Cubans are reacting, as we hear from WLRN's Danny Rivero.
The U.S. has imposed a so-called quarantine on Venezuelan oil. And President Donald Trump has declared that no more Venezuelan oil will be sent to Cuba. Oil that the government has relied on to keep the lights on. Sort of. Even with Venezuelan support, blackouts have recently been hitting much of the island for 20 hours a day, affecting everything from hospital power to food storage and manufacturing. President Trump told the Cuban government to, quote, make a deal with the United States before it's too late. With all this in mind, I spoke to five voices of Cuban and Cuban Americans about what this moment means for the future of Cuba, what they hope for, and what they fear. First is Orlando Gutierrez Boronat. He's the national secretary of the Cuban Democratic Directorate, a Miami-based group that works with dissidents on the island. He sees economic pressure from the U.S. government empowering dissidents in Cuba, leading to a collapse. But he doesn't think the government will fall in one big dramatic bang.
I see massive civil resistance and then the regime petering out. That's how I would, in a very general way, that's how I see it happening. Maybe there will be spectacular things here and there, but mostly that, just a wearing out and a collapse of the regime with a sustained civic uprising, which we're very close to. You really need profound change there. And that change has to come, and it has been coming from the Cuban society. Cubans have rebelled over and over again against that regime. It's a myth that they haven't. And every time they've been abandoned. Now, if there's real support this time from the U.S. and a real willingness to bring about democratic change, Cubans can do it. Cuban people want change. The Cuban people want that regime out.
Ricardo Torres is a Cuban economist who's a research fellow at American University in Washington. He said that Cuba losing access to Venezuelan oil will devastate the country economically in a way that worries him. About a third of Cuba's oil comes from Venezuela.
Energy is a key input. It does have a snowball effect throughout the economy. You need electricity and fuel for irrigation purposes in agriculture, for instance. Without irrigation, yields go down. Let us not forget that we're talking about people, right? So this is not objects. I've got family in living on the island. There is a balance that I hope becomes part of the discussion there. You may want to step up your pressure to signal your intent. I mean, we want change and we want to drive change or we want to accompany change in Cuba. On the other hand, on humanitarian grounds, you may want to be careful. My preferred course of action is that change must happen within Cuba.
Jose Daniel Ferrer is a longtime Cuban dissident. He was arrested during the island-wide protests in July of 2021 and was held as a political prisoner until last October, when he was released under the condition that he come to the U.S. Ferrer has met with Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And Ferrer wants U.S. pressure to ramp up, no matter the short-term costs, to force regime change.
El mejor momento que se ha vivido en los últimos 67 años.
This is the best moment we've had in the last 67 years. The U.S. has always been the country with the most solidarity with Cubans, but right now it's showing that solidarity very firmly and clearly. The U.S. is saying to the regime, either negotiate to leave or we will take you out. And that is motivating a lot of dissidents on the island.
No tienes otra opción que negociar antes que sea demasiado tarde. Se le acabaron los padrinos. Y eso para
I think the age of Cuba having strong supporters like the Soviet Union or Venezuela is over. The U.S. is helping, and Cubans on the island and off the island will keep moving against the government. I think the government is preparing itself for a collapse.
El régimen comienza a desmontarse, a caer.
Marcel Felipe is the chairman of the American Museum of the Cuban Diaspora in Miami, and he's a longtime supporter of regime change in Cuba. The way he sees it, with Marco Rubio leading the State Department, the decades-long dreams of Cuban Americans are finally within reach.
Well, ideally, to avoid bloodshed, I'd like to see the current dictators accept a negotiated exit so that we can start rebuilding Cuba. If they don't do that, I think there is going to be an exit for them anyways. It's just not going to be as orderly or as negotiated. So I hope that the day that, you know, as the president said, I hope they do that. I hope that President Trump continues relying on Marco Rubio's leadership. Our greatest worry is that there's people in the administration that do not want Marco Rubio to succeed. There's people in the administration that want the Cuba and Venezuelan policy to fail. So hopefully those voices will not prevail, and Marco Rubio's voice will continue to prevail.
Joe Garcia is a former Democratic member of Congress, and now he helps companies that want to do business on the island. With the Cuban government dead broke, the private sector is importing more goods to the island than the government for the first time since the 1960s. Garcia believes this is a historic opportunity for Cuban Americans to exploit the opening.
There are people in the administration who believe this is the moment to open up to private sector in Cuba. And very intelligently, when this administration wrote its policy on Cuba, it left in promoting private business in Cuba. Some of the people wanted to be against it. Philosophically, a lot of them are against it. We have a tremendous amount of accumulated political and economic power. And the proof is that almost $7 billion in remittances go in one form or another every year. And the question is, do we want to solve this problem or do we want to around with it endlessly? To what? Do we want Cuba to be like Haiti? Is that the victory? What is the victory? People are sitting in the dark in Cuba 22, 20, 21 hours a day. There are diseases like chikungunya and oropuche and dengue, which are ravaging the Cuban population. How much worse do we need to make it before we have a rational response and use our power for good?
For his part, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel has said the island nation is under attack from the U.S. and that Cuba will not negotiate its sovereignty with anyone. I'm Danny Rivero in Miami.
Florida's fields feed much of the nation, but for the workers tending the crops, extreme heat often turns a day's labor into a serious health risk. A new documentary examines the challenges of working outdoors as temperatures rise and legal protections erode. Public screenings of the film are being scheduled across the state, as we hear from Wilkeen Brutus.
No está bien. Y agarrando aire así. Y ese es un golpe de calor.
That's a farm worker describing his experience after struggling to breathe under the intense Florida sun, where the heat index can reach above 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Farm workers pick tomatoes, melons, and strawberries for hours, often without guaranteed access to water or shade. The new documentary, Without Shade, Without Rest, follows these workers as they endure not only punishing heat, but also retaliation for speaking out.
One of the things that stood out to us while making this film is how cumulative heat exposure can be. Sometimes we think, oh, heat exposure might be fainting spell or something we experience and then overcome and recover from.
Filmmaker Jose Zaragoza is co-founder of Six Eye Films. It's a journalist-led documentary nonprofit based in West Palm Beach. The film highlights voices from the farm workers describing dizzy spells, burns, and the fear of losing their jobs, alongside advocacy groups like the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and We Count. It's a worker-led organization based in Homestead who pushed for stronger heat protections in Miami-Dade County.
As you watch the film, you know that there's long-term effects that result from exposure to extreme heat, kidney problems, vision issues, exhaustion. You know, heat isn't just weather, it's a working condition. And here in Florida, it's a life or death one.
We Count's campaign came close to establishing what would have been a first-in-the-nation county heat standard, but lobbying from business and industry groups delayed the vote. Before it could pass, Florida's HB 433 banned local governments from enacting heat protection laws. Co-director Max Maldonado is a visual journalist and documentary filmmaker based in West Palm Beach. It's not your typical narration. Maldonado says the nonprofit wanted the film to avoid swaying public opinion by allowing conversations of farm workers, residents, and lawmakers to speak for themselves.
Nowadays, people are educated enough to be able to make those inferences and to also make those emotional judgment calls on certain topics when they're presented with the literal people that have experienced those said things. Allowing the person to tell their experiences rather than the voice summarizing it into a neat little box.
Hoy en la ley de que calor.
Under the campaign called Que Calor, meaning how hot, they asked for a county ordinance mandating breaks from working in the heat.
It would also create heat safety trainings as well as a new office to protect outdoor workers.
A 2024 Tampa Bay Times investigation found at least 37 heat-related worker deaths in Florida over the past decade, more than double the federal count. Nearly half involved farm workers, and about two-thirds of those deaths went unreported, meaning the true toll is likely higher.
Continues right now with Local 10's Annalise Garcia. She's in Homestead with more on the farm worker who died during that historic heat wave.
Efrain Lopez Garcia of Homestead. The farm worker complained about feeling sick during a shift out in the heat. The 30-year-old was found unresponsive and later pronounced dead.
Producer and editor Emily Sternlicht, who is based in New York, brought an outsider's perspective to the project, saying it brings unexpected insight into the produce she eats.
For someone from New York, it's really important to know that, you know, we consume a lot of these fruits and vegetables that come from Florida. It affects everyone in different ways, no matter where you are. Things that happen in Florida have repercussions throughout the country.
6i Films says they plan to continue screening the documentary across public institutions, such as libraries and schools, to raise awareness around the issue of heat and worker safety. I'm Wilkin Brutus in Palm Beach County.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, imagine flying Ubers zipping through the air above clogged highways around Florida. A legislative committee heard this week that it's no longer science fiction. The idea of flying past gridlock traffic isn't just possible, it's inevitable, as Gina Jordan reports.
We are looking at this from a transportation perspective as the age of flying cars.
State transportation leaders say advanced air mobility, known as AAM, is close to happening, maybe next year.
So you hear a lot of things, you know, are these drones that you can ride on? Is this going to be like the Jetsons? Is it flying Ubers? Is it air taxis? I think you could actually probably say yes to all of those.
Florida Department of Transportation Secretary Jared Perdue opened a panel discussion about the state's advanced air mobility business plan. He told the House Transportation and Economic Development Budget Subcommittee this could soon be a reliable way to get around.
And it could potentially have a very big impact on congestion relief and safety for transportation in the state of Florida. And so we have fully embraced the concept of the state of Florida FDOT really truly being a leader in this space. We want to be the first where these commercial vehicles take flight.
Florida lawmakers passed a bill last year directing FDOT to start incorporating AAM flights into the state's aviation system. That includes building vertiports. These are facilities just for aircraft known as eVTOLs. That stands for Electric Vertical Takeoff and Landing. DOT Assistant Secretary Will Watts says they still have to figure out how to manage airspace, like how high these aircraft will fly and how they'll deal with existing air traffic.
We recognize the need to develop the roadways, right? We got to develop the network that they need to fly on. And so the business plan rollout, we announced our recommended corridors with the nation's first aerial highway network, which is unlike anything ever established before.
First, they're focused on connecting key metro areas, beginning with the I-4 corridor through Central Florida, followed by Port St. Lucie to Miami. Other pathways in Phase 1 are Tampa to Naples, Miami to Key West, and Pensacola to Tallahassee. Charlie Hillis with the regional carrier Republic Airways says he sees a ton of potential routes.
Cities, towns, airports that are not connected today that could use this and make everyone's life a little bit better, a little easier. Take, for example, Tampa to Tallahassee. 4.5 hour drive, maybe 5.5 with traffic, 5.5, 6. We can fly that route in 41 minutes.
Republic Airways is looking to be a partner in bringing AAM to Florida. Hillis says the aircraft will range in size from 4 to 30 seats.
The 4 seats are typically eVTOL, so they lift up like a helicopter and then fly like an airplane. 9-seaters are more conventional, but they may have more propellers than you're used to seeing. And they'll be hybrids and not fully electric. In one case, there is one that we're interested in that's fully electric, but for the most part, it's hybrid. And then the short takeoff and landing, they're 9 seats also. But we also have, you know, if we're successful and there's more traffic than we think, we already have the short list of 19-seaters and 30-seaters.
Separate travel networks will be designed for passengers, freight, and emergency management. Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach is already preparing students for this industry.
We've set up a Center for Advanced Air Mobility, which we did directly in support of this initiative.
Rodney Cruz is Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of Embry-Riddle.
This is an investment by our organization. You know, we think that this is a game changer for us. You know, the need that you're going to have from a talent perspective for engineers, maintainers is absolutely huge.
Last September, the Trump administration announced a new pilot program within the Federal Aviation Administration to accelerate the deployment of AAM vehicles. Watts says Florida is well positioned to be chosen for the pilot.
And so we anticipate by the summer of 2026, we'll negotiate what our integrated partnership will be with FAA and probably have demonstration flights by the end of this year.
FDOT is now testing aircraft at the department's SunTrax facility in Polk County. I'm Gina Jordan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Danny Rivero and Wilkeen Brutus. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families. Committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.